Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Truth on the Tracks. I'm Brandon Turbeville, your host. Tonight is July the 20th, 2015. We're going to discuss a number of different topics tonight. Of course, we've got to talk about ISIS, the Middle East, the recent shootings, some terrorist, alleged terrorist acts that were foiled. We're also going to talk about a bill coming out in California now trying to mandate adult vaccinations, as well as the new hacker video that was released regarding the staged beheading videos, the Joel Robinson arrest. We're going to have a call for action with the listeners here when we get to that. We're also going to talk about the Kuwait DNA database. So you've got a tall order to get involved with tonight, a lot of stuff to cover, and hopefully we'll be able to do that, be able to do justice to all of these topics. But before we get into that, I'd like to remind you that you can catch Truth on the Tracks here every Monday night and Friday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or rather, every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can catch the show being rebroadcast any other night, Tuesday to Sunday, at different times on UCY. Just go check the schedule page, and you should be able to find out when it's being rebroadcast. Being rebroadcast 7 nights a week, as well as on Reality Bites Radio, and we continue to expand. If you're interested in my work, then I'd encourage you to check out ActivistPost.com and NaturalBlaze.com. In addition, if you're interested in my work specifically, I would encourage you to go to BrandonTurbeville.com, and that is the website where I repost all of my articles, all the YouTube videos, all the archive versions of this show, all the announcements, all the relevant information is there. Of course, if you want to find the books, just go to the books tab. That'll take you to the bookstore. And if you want to find the events that may be coming up in the future, then please go to the events tab. So all of that relevant information is at BrandonTurbeville.com. And the archive of this show will be posted there as well in an MP3 link and YouTube video format. So BrandonTurbeville.com. Now, let's start off with some events here in South Carolina because they are newsworthy and noteworthy. I guess we'll start with the sickening display at the state capitol on the 18th of the KKK and the NBP, the New Black Panthers, meeting one another at the state capitol for a festival of savagery and barbarianism or barbarism and ape-like behavior, basically. This was a group of animals, and this shows what happens when you have rabid animals in the same location when you take them out to the park and you don't have a leash on them. This is what they do. They go to the state capitol and they attack one another over racial identity. So there was violence. We knew there would be violence. That was not surprising at all. And there were a few arrests. Of course, we got to ask, where were the riot cops? Where was the tear gas? Where were the MRAPs? Well, the riot cops weren't there because they wanted a riot. Let's face it. What this was about was to create racial hatred and create violence. Now, this is going to be broadcast back to the rest of the world as whites and blacks fighting one another, and I have to say that the overwhelming majority of whites and blacks, especially here in South Carolina, are not represented by this human filth. In fact, most people are generally turned off by the KKK or the MBP. Again, these two groups are a collection of human trash, and they are generally run by intelligence agencies or the FBI, for instance, specifically. Also, the Southern Poverty Law Center, believe it or not, is heavily involved in running these groups as well. And, of course, George Soros sending money to some of the ones on the left. So that's what this is. It's all theater to drum up racial hatred, divide and conquer method that's been used so well before. So, again, no riot cops here, and it's funny that the KKK had gotten a permit to go out to the state capitol and do a rally, and the NBP apparently was able to get a permit as well. So if that's the case, And we've got to, we'd have to do more investigating, which we're probably not going to do because this is not something that warrants too much attention. But if the MVP was able to get a permit on the same day, that's very, very interesting because if generally speaking at the state capitol, if you sign up for a permit and you, or you're granted a permit of a protest from say 1 to 3 p.m., then no one else can get a permit to protest at 1 to 3, maybe from 12 to 1, maybe from 3 to 4, but not 1 to 3. So it's interesting that both these groups would have the permission to go out and demonstrate at the same time when anybody could see it was going to be a violent display of animal behavior. So what this is nothing but an attempt to create racial animosity, to provoke violence between the two groups. And what can we say? It's over now. The KKK groups and the neo-Nazis are going back to their FBI-run infested holes where they were to begin with. And the NBP crowd from Florida, that drove all the way up here from Florida, are going back to their George Soros-funded FBI-run holes in that state. So there we are. That's the gist of that. Don't judge the racial situation in South Carolina based on what you saw on the state capitol on Saturday. So hopefully this will blow over, but it doesn't seem that the powers that be are trying to allow this to blow over. So I implore all of my listeners, black, white, Latino, whatever, to take a deep breath. Don't get so heavily involved in this question of racial superiority or racial injustice, who's suffered the worst oppression in the last 100 years or who suffered the worst oppression in the last 10 years. Just take a deep breath and try to deal with your neighbors as human beings and on an individual basis, and don't let the television control your behavior. Just we've got to diffuse this situation as best as we can. So that's all we're going to say about that. Now let's turn to another South Carolina issue, and we're going to talk about this is going to be your call to action if you are a listener to this show. What I want you to do, I'm going to go through this story here in a second so you can see what I'm talking about, but the article is long prison term given to man who shot DEA agent he thought was home intruder. And that's up at Activist Post. It's up at BrandonTurberville.com. This happened in South Carolina. I'll give you the call to action after I finish the going through the details so you can understand what the context is here. Now, in Orangeburg, South Carolina, we had an individual named Joel Robinson. It was at night. It was just before dawn, just a couple of hours just before dawn. He wakes up to the sound of intruders in his home, and these intruders had apparently burst into his house. They had apparently announced themselves by screaming police as they burst in, right? They were really largely unannounced, but they stormed inside the guy's house, in Robinson's house, with their guns drawn. And Robinson, who was, apparently sleeping, did what any self-respecting person and person who thought they were threatened would do. He picked up his gun and he fired on the guys coming into his house, and he hit one in the arm. But unfortunately for Joel Robinson, these home intruders were actually DEA agents, and that's the special kind of home intruder who can invade your home in the middle of the night, draw guns on you, and face no repercussions for doing so. So unfortunately for Robinson, the judicial system seems to agree with the DEA in that they're not only above the law, but they clearly are a higher class of citizen that has the authority to violate every right in the book and threaten citizens with death and bodily harm, and there's nothing the victim can do but beg for the kindness of the officer not to kill him. In fact, that's virtually what the court proceedings have stated in Robinson's trial. So, Joel Robinson was given 8 years in prison for shooting the DEA agent Barry Wilson. Robinson had shot Wilson in the arm. It broke his elbow. It broke his forearm. And the truth of the matter is that Wilson should be apologizing to Robinson. He should be thanking Joel Robinson that by kicking in his door and running into his house with a gun drawn, that Joel didn't kill him. But instead, Wilson went to court and he dramatized the issue. And this is what he says: 2 inches higher and it would have been a headshot. 2 inches lower and it could have gone under my bulletproof vest. Oh, the horror. Well, you shouldn't have kicked in his door and pulled a gun on him. Don't look for pity on this show. Now, you would logically think that Wilson's injury would be a lesson as to why you shouldn't invade another person's home unannounced and armed, but Wilson argued that Joel Robinson had no reason to shoot at the DA agents because, you know, this was, again, a no-knock raid. And a no-knock raid is a home invasion, by the way. The only knocking they do is when they kick your door in. But the DA agents claim Robinson didn't even ask who we were, as if there's time to just engage in casual conversation with a home intruder if an attack is taking place, right? And if the police wanted Robinson to know who they were, they could have knocked on the damn door. They could have announced themselves in a civilized fashion, in a professional fashion, instead of just yelling police as they're kicking the man's door in and coming in with guns. That's not how you announce yourself. That's how police states and Stasi forces and the military announces itself. Now, Wilson said that if Joel Robinson had believed he was a victim of a home invasion, he should have called 911. 911 if you're the victim of a home invasion. More victimhood and perpetual victimhood there in place. Robinson was facing 30 years in prison for shooting this criminal who kicked in his door. But he took a plea deal to receive the 8-year prison sentence. Now, federal prosecutors had agreed to drop the charges of manufacturing and distributing illegal drugs if Joel Robinson would plead guilty to shooting Wilson, so Robinson accepted the plea deal. Now, I got to point out, no drugs were found in Robinson's house at all. All right? So they dropped a charge that they had no proof that he committed that crime. So Robinson was, when he went to trial, he was forced to go through this humiliating display of apology and regret to these criminal officers. And his lawyers also expressed gratitude and thanks to the DEA for not murdering Robinson, as they, quote, had the right to do. They didn't have the right to do that. They didn't have the right to kick in his door based on the Constitution. And that's, and basic common law. They didn't have the right to do that at all. In fact, Robinson had every right to kill each and every one of them. So that it should be the opposite. But regardless, Robinson is also ordered to pay, after he does 8 years in prison, he's ordered to pay $82,158 in medical bills to the criminal officer that he shot, the shot that went through his arm. So the bills were covered by government medical and disability insurance, but they're still making Robinson pay that. All right, so I guess this is the perk of the job for Wilson. He got shot, so he gets $82,000 in the process of violating a person's rights, kicking in their door, threatening them, and then getting dealt with in a very, a very merciful fashion, nonetheless. Now, I understand why Robinson accepted the plea deal. We all do, right? Most Americans are terrified of facing a jury of their peers, no matter how innocent they may be and no matter how much evidence that proves them to be innocent, because America has this indoctrinated love affair with the cop, and they have a manufactured fear of their fellow citizens. It's a media-induced, sadistic obsession with law and punishment and heavy-handedness. And so most victims would rather take a little sentence now than a much longer sentence later when their peers find them guilty, despite all logical evidence to the contrary. So this is a perfect example of why the war on drugs has to be ended immediately, and the DEA must eventually be eliminated entirely, or at least vastly reduced and refocused outward for, sort of underground drug trades. But personally, I think we should eliminate the DEA entirely. It's the drug enforcement agencies. There's one solution to the problem in the war on drugs. And you want government cuts, libertarians? You want government cuts, Republicans? Let's cut the DEA. Let's just get rid of it. It's got no purpose. It's the drug enforcement agency. Nobody should be enforcing laws against substances that you put into your own body. So let's cut all of those parasites, all of those government workers that you hate so much, Republicans and Austrian school economists. Let's get rid of the DEA. Let's make that our first cut. So we also need to put in stronger protections for victims like Joel Robinson, but that's for the future. That's for the offensive action that we want to be talking about at some other point in the future. What I want you to do right now is to get on Twitter. I want you to get on Facebook and Twitter. Some of you are on both. Some of you are on neither. And if you're on neither, I guess you're probably smarter than the average bear. But if you're on both for political purposes, let's get this article out. Go to my website, BrandonTurbeville.com, and find the article, Long Prison Term Given to Man Who Shot DEA Agent He Thought Was Home Intruder. You can get that article at my website, or you can go to Google and type that in, right? Again, you can pull it up from BrandonTurbeville.com or ActivistPost.com or anywhere else it's reposted. I don't care. But the title is Long Prison Term Given to Man Who Shot DEA Agent He Thought Was Home Intruder. I want you to get that article. I want you to share it on Facebook. I want you to share it on Twitter. And particularly on Twitter, I want a Twitter storm with hashtag Free Joel Robinson. And if you're having trouble finding the article, just put my name in, Brandon Turbeville, Joel Robinson. And the article will come up in some form. So just take that, share the article, hashtag Free Joel Robinson. And you can even do that on Facebook. So that's a very small bit of action that we can do, but I want you to start getting involved. You know, this is the type of action that, in the grand scheme of things, you know, this is not sit-ins and Tiananmen Square, but it's something we can do to try to raise awareness of what's happened to this man, and hopefully help get him out. So let's try the Twitter storm. It's literally the least you can do. It only takes a few moments of your time. Most of you are on social media all day anyway, so it really shouldn't be much of an inconvenience. So again, hashtag Free Joel Robinson. Let's get that out there, and let's make that a big part of the coming week. Now, let's transition to just some international issues if we can. Well, actually, you know what? There's a couple of other things I want to talk about. First of all, we have, on the domestic front, the question of the July 4th terror attacks. Remember, we were told that there were going to be terror attacks on July 4th, and there was not any terror attacks on July 4th. It was an exercise in paranoia to frighten Americans into giving up what little freedom they have left. But there we are. We've got this fear-mongering regarding the terror attacks over July 4th, it never happened. Well, after it was pointed out that it never happened, the FBI suddenly says, well, no, we actually did make arrests, and we stopped the possible terrorist attacks in the United States over the July 4th holiday. And they, for instance, they arrested Alexander Ciccolo, a 23-year-old, that they said was taken into custody on gun charges after buying two pistols, two rifles from an undercover FBI confidential informant, according to federal officials, and those were unnamed. They searched his apartment. They said they found it loaded with possible bomb-making equipment, including a pressure cooker, a variety of chemicals, an alarm clock, along with attack planning papers and jihad paperwork. They said the FBI agent said that Ciccolo used the name Abu Ali Amriki, and that neighbors said he was a recent convert to Islam. And one senior federal official, and that's what ABC News refers to them as, says this is a very bad person arrested before he could do very bad things. Well, okay, pre-crime, I guess. But first of all, let's look at what he had in his apartment. He has guns, okay. You've got a right to guns. He has Possible bomb-making equipment. Okay, that is a very very vague description, right? Because in the same way that law enforcement tends to use household chemicals, a funnel, and a tourniquet as a meth lab, they could use basic household chemicals and consider that possible bomb-making equipment. Again, it doesn't say bomb-making equipment. It says possible bomb-making equipment. So we don't even know what that means. It's material that could be used to make a bomb. Well, you know, it might be surprising for most people to know that you've got that material in your home if you know what you're doing. And, you know, so this guy probably had innocuous material there. Also, they found a pressure cooker. Oh, my God, a pressure cooker in an apartment? Say it isn't so. A variety of chemicals. Again, anybody has a variety of chemicals in their home. An alarm clock. An alarm clock in an apartment. You mean to tell me that an alarm clock is now terrorist material? An alarm clock, for God's sake. And attack planning papers. Well, what is that? What is an attack planning paper? And a jihad paperwork. Well, is that a Quran? I mean, we don't know. We don't know what all this stuff is. But here's what is interesting. Ciccolo's father was Captain Robert Ciccolo. He is a veteran commander assigned to operations at Boston Police Headquarters. He was one of those officers that responded to the Boston bombing in April of 2013. He said, according to the FBI, that his son was inspired by the marathon bombing and the use of the pressure cookers and told the FBI undercover operative, Allahu Akbar, I got the pressure cooker today. Okay, so they're saying that he was, the FBI basically operated in a sting or investigation sort of slash sting operation with this guy, and then they busted him. But again, the son of Captain Ciccolo of the Boston Police Department, this is very interesting to say the least, and I think people could do their own digging. This is a guy, Alexander Ciccolo, this kid who apparently turned into a jihadist, was quite the peace activist some time before. Only if you go to July 2012, Ciccolo was a big peace activist. He was a nonviolent protester, a nonviolent peace protester. According to Jun Yasuda, who was a Buddhist who was taking part in peace rallies with Alexander Ciccolo, she says, "We walked together after Fukushima, and he realized that he had an open mind and that people were wonderful." So that's quite the change. And again, his connections to his father being the big captain of the police force there—that's something. That's something to be investigated in the near future. Now, we had the Tennessee shootings coming up, or the just past. We had the Tennessee shootings where the military recruitment center and there were several soldiers killed there, again, on the attacks on the U.S. military. So what is this? And it's apparently done by ISIS, right? That's what we're being told, is that it was committed by ISIS. Now, the group or the individual who was allegedly responsible for this, the Abdul Aziz, was the shooter. It says that in Yahoo News, there is an article, "Shootings at Chattanooga Military Facilities Leave Four Marines, Gunmen Dead, Act Called Domestic Terrorism." Now, in the article, another unnamed U.S. official tells the Associated Press that Abdulaziz had not been on the radar of federal law enforcement before the shooting on Thursday. Okay, I guess that was a statement to try to head off all the criticism of the fact that the FBI has been following and in contact with virtually every single incident or shooter and every single incident of domestic terrorism in the United States over the last several years. So at some point, you know, if we were just perplexed and uninformed viewers, we would have to ask, why in the hell do we have the FBI working on this to begin with? Because it's not working. At some point we would just say, let's just cut the program, let the attacks go through and save the money, because at least we're not going to be broke and attacked. At least we'll be attacked, but we'll have a little extra change. But of course we know that this is actually the plan. This is all created and orchestrated by U.S. intelligence agencies to begin with, so it's working quite well. The system that the FBI has in place here is working quite well. So I got off topic. Abdulaziz, the shooter, Yahoo News' article, shootings at Chattanooga military facilities leave four Marines gunmen dead, act called domestic terrorism, says that Abdulaziz was not on the radar of federal law enforcement before Thursday shootings, but his father had been investigated several years ago for possible ties to a foreign terrorist organization and was added to the U.S. terrorist watch list, according to a report in the New York Times, but that probe did not surface information about Abdulaziz. Give me a break. The FBI was monitoring and tracking the Chattanooga shooter's family for years before this shooting took place. So, yeah, the FBI did indeed have a hand in this incident as well. And I think that is clear enough, and people can do, again, more research on their own. So they can go check that out if they so desire. Now let's move on to California briefly. We have SB 792, the first U.S. adult vaccine mandate with no personal exemptions, only medical exemptions approved by a doctor and defined by the bill, and criminal penalties for failure to comply. That is being heard in the California Assembly Human Services Committee on, it's already been heard, I believe. And this bill would essentially eliminate an adult's right to exempt themselves from one, some, or all vaccines. And so there we are. So it would begin on September 1st, 2016. It says a person shall not be employed at a family daycare home if he or she has not been immunized against influenza, pertussis, and measles. An employee shall receive an influenza vaccination between August 1st and December 1st of each year. Another excerpt from the bill says, this bill, commencing September 1st, 2016, would prohibit a daycare center or a family daycare home from employing any person who has not been immunized in accordance with the schedule for routine adult immunizations prescribed by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The bill would specify circumstances under which a person would be exempt from the immunization requirement based on medical safety and current immunity as specified. The bill would make conforming changes to provisions that set forth qualifications for daycare center teachers and applicants for licensure as a family daycare center, because the bill would extend the application of a crime under the act. The bill would impose a state-mandated local program. So you can go find more details about that bill. Find out the lunatics that are supporting it. Contact them and let them know that their time is limited in the California Senate or California House if they pass this bill. California really is imposing the police state medical dictatorship and, pretty much every negative aspect of this global system is being implemented in California and New York, and as California and New York go, so go the rest of the country. So it's time to stop that there. The bill is called, again, SB 792, and as if you're on the internet, Twitter storm for Free Joel Robinson, then you could shoot one out, stop SB 792 if you want as well. Now we've got to, we really got to move on. Transitioning with the question of Lindsey Graham in his recent statement about troops in Iraq and Syria. Now, with few exceptions, the 2016 elections they're just becoming an exercise where candidates jockey for the title of the biggest warmonger, particularly in the Republican race. And if that contest is what the race is, it would have been won a long time ago if rhetoric and war psychosis were the only criteria, because Lindsey Graham has received a head start in the competition for this regular incitements to war and his most vociferous support of foreign entanglements and most psychotic suggestions for U.S. foreign policy. Graham recently went to attempt to clinch the win in this contest by giving his first major foreign policy speech at the Atlantic Council think tank in Washington, D.C. Graham's speech was designed to be a preview as to what he would do if he were elected president, which should never, ever happen, by the way. A speech that really shortly turned into a list of countries he would bomb, countries he would invade, and countries he would bomb and invade. So Graham went on to pronounce that he believed the U.S. should commit 20,000 troops to Syria and Iraq in order to fight ISIS, allegedly, right? The same terrorist organization that his friend John McCain helped organize, train, fund, and direct. And, of course, we also have Miss Lindsay standing next to Abdul-Bahaj in Libya, another terrorist. Now, Graham wants to increase the number of U.S. military advisors on the ground in Iraq from 3,500 to 10,000 and to include special forces. He wants a similar number on the ground in Syria. And then he went on to laughably state that Iran poses, quote, the greatest existential threat to the world order today, end quote. And if and he also said if the Iranians refuse to knuckle under and accept the U.S. demands as opposed to a deal, which is itself an insult to the sovereign nation of Iran, he would commit the United States to yet another war. This is what he says. I don't want a war, but if that's what you want, you're going to lose it. We're going to sink your Navy and shoot your Air Force down. Well, that sounds like something coming out of a third grader's mouth, to be honest. And of course, that's what resonates with the general public, is being talked to like their children, and that's how Graham has managed to getting his message across. So, his statements really resemble more the playing out of some psychopathic, childish fantasy than the statements of any lucid candidate for public office, and especially that of the presidency. But he's never acted lucid, and unfortunately Americans never really demanded lucidity from their leaders. So we're not going to spend much more time on Lindsey Graham. Let's move on and try to look at the question of the video. We should talk about this hacker video that shows staged beheading footage. And we all know that John McCain has a sordid history with ISIS and terrorism and color revolutions. That's been demonstrated time and time again. But we have a new video released by a Ukrainian hacker group entitled Cyber Bakut. And if it turns out to be real, McCain's ties to terrorism and domestic war propaganda become even more demonstrative. We have only a few days ago, or I guess several days ago now, Cyber Bakut released a video purporting to show the studio creation of one of these ISIS beheading videos of Western journalists. This video shows a movie studio complete with a camera and a directing crew, as well as a small stage set with background and dirt for setting. On his knees is this man. He's a bald man that some people are claiming to be Stephen Sotloff, although if you look at it, other people are suggesting James Foley, and it's really unclear because it's taken back at a distance. And to his side is another individual dressed in all black with his face covered. Basically, he's dressed up as Jihadi John, and he is, going through a speech and then reaches over and starts cutting the throat of the guy in the orange suit, the bald guy in the orange suit. So it looks like one of these videos. So let's take a look, see how much more time we have here. We've got, yeah, we can go through the description of the video from translated from the Russian from Cyber Bakut. Here's one of the things I will point out. Well, let's just read. This was apparently hacked from John McCain's a device belonging to one of John McCain's aides as he passed through Ukraine. But let me read the statement from Cyber Bakut on their website regarding this video, and then we'll talk about the authenticity. They say, "We, Cyber Bakut, received at the disposal of the file whose value cannot be overstated. Dear Senator McCain, we recommend you next time in foreign travel, and especially on the territory of Ukraine, not to take confidential documents. And one of the devices of your colleagues, we found a lot of interesting things. Something we decided to put. This video should become the property of the international community. If the video is real, it should indeed become property of the international community. All right, so that was the statement from Saber Berkut. Now, we have to think about the authenticity of this video. Just look at some of the questions surrounding it. There is a legitimate question as to whether or not this is real or not. Of course, it's not been confirmed as real yet. We suspect that considering John McCain's connections to terrorism, this is very much possible. We also know that the videos that were played out on Western mainstream media channels regarding the beheadings, in other words, the beheading videos, were clearly faked. So again, this adds credence to the video, but we don't know for sure yet. There are some questions as to, I think some people have raised the question, well, why would ISIS need to fake a beheading to begin with? And there are also questions, you know, if you're taking a video of the video, why would you videotape the studio set? In other words, why would you take it far enough back that you could see the cameras? Well, those are good questions. And of course, ISIS wouldn't need to behead or wouldn't need to fake a beheading video. They behead enough people unless there is some type of CIA asset involved. And notice that the only videos that were released in terms of beheading videos, the only ones that were released with such massive professional production were the ones that involved Western journalists or Western agents or Japanese or French or British. Those were the only ones that were released with such production. So I think we have some support for the authenticity of the video, to be honest. So as I said, if the video is real, it should indeed become property of the international community, but we just need to confirm the authenticity, which hopefully is being worked on. You know, also to point out, Saber Berkut is Ukrainian, but it is pro-Russian, so it does have a vested interest in seeing John McCain and U.S. intelligence agencies humiliated. But if it was connected to Russian intelligence, one would expect that the production of that video itself would have been somewhat better. So we will leave that. So again, it can't be confirmed as 100% authentic as of yet, but the video might present more evidence that these beheading videos were actually created in a studio and controlled setting. There have been other media outlets who have revealed that this is entirely possible to stage this beheading video using a basic studio setting. You don't even need high-quality equipment to do these videos in the way that they were presented to the American people. So, again, not going to come down on the side of is this real or not, not going to plant our flag anywhere on this issue, but we are going to say that this is obviously something that has the possibility to be a major revelation. So there we go. Now, the question of Yemen, we've had the Yemeni forces, this is the Yemeni government forces that are loyal to Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi, who is now in exile in Saudi Arabia, essentially running the government from Saudi Arabia after he was run out by the Houthis. But now these Yemeni forces have been backed up by the Arab-led coalition that have bombed civilians left and right all over the country, bombed the Houthis. But these Yemeni forces have apparently recaptured the international airport at Aden from the Houthi rebels. So this is something that is unfortunate, but this is could be the ebb and flow of battle. This is the airport. It's not necessarily the port of Aden in total. So that's something to be watching, and we'll continue to follow the Yemeni situation as well. Now, we've also got these reports. There's been a communique that has recently come out, and that is the Office of the President of Iraqi Kurdistan issued a statement on June 24th saying that President Masoud Barzani met with the U.S. Ambassador to Baghdad, Stuart Jones, and the U.S. Consul General in Erbil, Joseph Pennington, and several military commanders. And it was revealed that the Pentagon intends on placing units of U.S. troops, including special forces, in the autonomous Kurdish region. And Western media reported that military technology and weapons and equipment is going to be delivered in Kurdistan to help, quote, fight against the Islamic State terrorist, end quote. And, of course, we know that's going to be used for the armament, actually, of Kurdish groups fighting the jihadist. And we went through this question of the carving out of Kurdistan last week. So this is an interesting development. And there's been some reportage on this as well. So we'll keep following that. We also know that this splitting up of Iraq into three separate states is now becoming an even open discussion, an even open reality. We have, in addition to this meeting in Erbil, of course, we know that the U.S. tends to be more hesitant to arm Shiite fighters, but we have this statement by U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter saying that the Obama administration is ready to accept the disintegration of Iraq as a unified nation state, right? He says, quote, "That is an important part of our strategy now on the ground. If the government can't do what it's supposed to do, then we will try to enable local ground forces if they're willing to partner with us to keep stability in Iraq. But there will not be a single state of Iraq." That's Ashton Carter. So that was actually stated rather openly. Now, of course, again, this idea, the talks in Erbil have really confirmed the idea that we've been mentioning for a long time, that the U.S. is not going to strengthen the Shiites in Iraq, and it's fine with the country being divided on this ethnic and religious basis, and that's what's actually being promoted there. So, again, we're going to talk about that more in depth in the near future. Also, the question of Turkey and ISIS crossing the border of Turkey. We have these reports. Late last year, we had Deutsche Welle in Germany reporting on what turned out to be hundreds of trucks a day carrying billions of dollars worth of supplies flowing across the Turkish border into Syria directly into the hands of the Islamic State. The border crossing near the Turkish city of Ankupinar, which is approximately 100 kilometers west of the Syrian city of Ain al-Arab, which is also known as Kobani to the Western audiences now because it's the Kurdish name, it's apparently just one of many crossings where ISIS fighters and the weapons they use and the material they use for supplies go directly under the watch and assistance of NATO. Remember, Turkey is a NATO country. Now, Time put out an article recently, ISIS fighters kill 200 civilians in Syrian town, and this is the quote, "The attacks also came after the group, ISIS, suffered a series of setbacks over the past 2 weeks, including the loss last week of the Syrian border town of Tal Abyad, one of the group's main points for bringing in foreign fighters and supplies," end quote. So Tal Abyad is a Turkish-Syrian border crossing town that's east of Kobani, or east of Ain al-Arab. It's a second confirmed point of entry into Syria used by ISIS to resupply its campaign within the country. So we have this confirmed and extensive logistical network passing through NATO and U.S. ally territory into Syria. And, of course, that contradicts the narrative that ISIS is this indigenous terrorist organization that came out of nowhere, that funds itself through oil deals and commerce within the territory that it holds. So The Western media has really tried to promote this idea with no evidence whatsoever that ISIS is this immense global operation somehow underwritten by ransom payments and black market oil from Eastern Syria. But that's obviously not the case. These reports are not even tenable. They're just simply untrue. And we've went through that many times here on this show, and there's no point to go through it any more in depth. If you want to catch up on it, you can go hear previous shows. You can go repeatedly. So if the supplies were really flowing over the Syrian-Iraqi border, the NATO powers might be able to argue plausible deniability, because you know neither nation would be able to control either side of the border because of this fighting. But Turkey is a NATO member, and it has been since 1952, and it's a host of the United States Air Force, Incirlik Air Force Base, right? And it has a full control of its borders. So it means that ISIS-bound convoys not only pass over the Turkish borders with the apparent approval, obvious approval of Turkish border guards, but that they're assembled somewhere within Turkey itself before arriving at the edge of Syria. So this is something that Deutsche Welle didn't really touch on, and the Western media tends not to touch on either. Now, I want to really get one last point in here. So we're going to move on to the Kuwait issue. This is not really related to Middle East geopolitics, but the country has never been known for its human rights and civil liberties. Kuwait is now attempting to lead the Gulf for the country that's been most integrated with the technological control grid and biometric surveillance state. They've recently passed a law that mandates every person residing in Kuwait must submit to a DNA sample test that will be stored in a massive database, and there will be criminal penalties for refusal. There'll be fines, there'll be jail time. And of course, what does that remind you of? California? So Kuwait has 1.3 million citizens that are there, and there's also 2.9 million foreign residents, and they're all going to be subject to the law. So any person who refuses to submit to the DNA test and DNA swab and data mining operation are going to be subject to $33,000 in fines, interesting number, and up to 1 year in prison. Any person who provides a fake sample will face up to 7 years in prison. Now, Kuwait passed this law conveniently after the alleged Islamic State, so the NATO-directed bombing of a Shiite mosque on June the 26th. Remember, we talked about that bombing here on this show. The law is being justified as a way to make it easier for law enforcement to track down criminals and terrorists after the attacks have been committed. The incident is just really another problem reaction solution style terrorist attack that's justifying even more totalitarian police state responses. And we've got an independent member of parliament, Jamal al-Omar, saying, "We have approved the DNA testing law and approved the additional funding. We are prepared to approve anything needed to boost security measures in the country." So Kuwait is now the only country in the world that makes DNA tests and participation in DNA database compulsory. But really, it's just going to be the first. Remember, we've got many countries like England, Australia, Sweden, the United States, for instance, they all maintain stored databases of DNA of convicted criminals. And the U.S., of course, leading as usual in police state methodologies, they are maintaining a database of the DNA of even those people who have been arrested, even though they've not been convicted. So the U.S. also maintains a database of the DNA of missing persons and their families, so that's growing and growing. So I guess we would be second to Kuwait in the level of DNA databases. We've got a growing number of countries that are building these type of databases. Remember, in 2012, we've had India launching this nationwide program. It's allocation of a unique identification number to every single one of its 1.2 billion residents. Each one of those numbers are tied to a biometric data of the recipient, using three different forms of information, fingerprints, iris scans, and pictures of the face, and all 10 digits of the hand are recorded, as well as both eyes scanned. We also have the Japanese that have a mandatory national UID system in place and have since 2002 under the Basic Resident Register Program. Under the BRR, each individual has to provide their name, birth date, gender, and physical address to municipal governments, who then use that information to issue the citizen a UID. They had an update to that initiative called the My Number Bill, which was introduced in February 2012, that streamlined that information and the sharing process of that information between governments, like tax offices, social security offices, emergency mitigation agencies, that sort of thing. And it was just the next phase toward the goal of the Japanese government being able to centralize the data that they collected from each one of those citizens. So that information on Japanese citizens under the current system is being fed in this nationwide computer database known as the JukiNet, which is made up of 3,200 municipal governments. So the JukiNet serves as the common data sharing database between the municipal governments and to some extent even the central government. And of course, Israel, also another country not known for its human rights, has a mandatory biometrics program. It was passed in the Knesset in December 2009. The biometric database law is the name of that, and it mandates the collection of fingerprints and facial images from all Israeli residents, and it integrates those biometric details in domestic ID cards and national passports. That law also has the creation of biometric government databases for the purpose of managing access control and, of course, identification of individuals, and to help the law enforcement agencies locate criminal suspects. So the law was justified under curbing identity theft, just like in India, and it was also justified under curbing the loss and theft of ID cards and that sort of thing that was issued by the Interior Ministry. There was a report submitted to the Prime Minister's office and to the Knesset chairman where it was emphasized the importance of implementing the biometric system and that the transition would be gradual, I guess, so as not to alarm the citizens. So most of the data collection and database storage via biometrics in the U.S. is rolled out under the auspices of greater convenience, like biometric concepts like biometric programs for food stamp recipients and employee tagging are gaining traction, though. That's not convenience except for the government and the employers. So it's indicating that with that push growing, that the eventual mandating of participation in this type of program will not be far off. And, of course, you have California mandating vaccines and that sort of thing, so you can see where this is all going. Now, just in the last couple of minutes that we have left, we have to talk about the Greece situation, the Greek sellout, because that's what it is. Anybody telling you that Greece is that Tsipras did not sell you out, I'm sorry. This is it, all you have to do is look at what transpired. Now, the Greek deal that Tsipras has now agreed to is even worse than the austerity measures had they just accepted the austerity measures to begin with, because now they've defaulted. Now they don't really have any money coming in. So this is even worse. It would have been better off if Tsipras had just accepted the austerity deal and moved on. Now, what do we make of this? What do we make of the sellout? Was this a plan all along to bring in the radical left Syriza party and then stab everyone in the back? I honestly don't think so. I think something shifted between the election of Tsipras and even more so after the public voting, after the resolution went to the Greek people to accept or reject the austerity measures. And the reason I say that is because there would have been no point in having such a referendum if you were going to implement austerity to begin with, because that would have only antagonized the Greek people. But there's no question that Tsipras sold those people out. They had a referendum. He came to power, for instance, and this is he came to power promising no austerity. He meets with the Eurogarchs and the IMF and the European Central Bank, essentially the austerity ghouls, but he meets with the Eurogarchs and he comes out and he provides the Greek people with even worse austerity. What is that if it's not a sellout? So it's time for the Greek people to realize that they don't really have any allies in their government at all. And while we don't want to see riots, that's pointless, destroying property in that sense, we can see that the Greek people are angry, and we certainly support them. A national strike, absolutely. National strike, massive public protest, massive non-compliance, all of this needs to be part of the Greek discourse, because Tsipras is a sellout, and it's time to throw him out, as well as the other parties that are involved in the Greek government, because they are not bringing the bacon. So it's time. If nobody else is going to step up, then it's time to show them the door so they can step out. Now, ladies and gentlemen, again, I want to remind you all that we've got a little bit of action tonight. Start now. If you're listening to the show, you're listening online, go to Twitter, send out the article, long prison term given to man who shot DEA agent he thought was home intruder. If you can't find the article, go to Google, type in my name, Brandon Turbeville, and then Joel Robinson after it, and the article will come up. Share the article with your commentary, whatever it may be, and the hashtag Free Joel Robinson. Share that. That is your call to action tonight. This man does not deserve to be in prison. He was defending himself. It was the police and the DEA who were responsible for what happened. They bear the sole responsibility for what happened. So again, find the article, share the article with your own commentary. Hashtag Free Joel Robinson. So stick with us next week. The show's going to be rebroadcast throughout the week, every night this week at different times. You can check the UCY schedule page to see when it's going to be rebroadcast. But other than that, we will be back Monday night with a new program at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This has been Truth on the Tracks. I'm Brandon Turbeville. We'll see you next week.